they were so fixed on making somebody pay for the crime. It wasn't about making the right person pay. You know, in that car, he said, let me tell you something. I don't care whether you did it or didn't do it. I'm gonna make sure you found guilty of it.
The Profile with Premier Christianity Magazine.
Welcome to The Profile podcast, brought to you by the team at Premier Christianity Magazine, the UK's leading Christian magazine. Here on The Profile, we like to delve deep into the life of Christian leaders from all different walks of life and hear something of their inspirational stories. And my guest today is certainly in that inspirational category. I'd say probably one of the most inspiring people I've ever had the privilege of meeting and spending some time with. Anthony Ray Hinton spent nearly 30 years on death row for a crime that he did not commit. I have been speaking to him about how his Christian faith sustained him during that period and why he believes that God had a plan even in the midst of that great injustice. This is a show you do not want to miss. So without any further ado, this is it. Here is my conversation with Anthony Ray Hinton.
You're listening to The Profile.
Hello, you are listening to Premier Christian Radio. I'm Sam Hales, and I have come to Hailey Christian Conference Centre for this week's show, and I'm here with a very special guest, Anthony Ray Hinton. You're going to hear his incredible story over the next few minutes. Anthony, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and as people can tell from your accent, you are not from the UK. Where are you from?
I'm from the United States, Birmingham, Alabama.
So tell me a little bit about life growing up. Your life changed dramatically in your 20s.
Absolutely.
When something very unexpected happened to you. So just set the scene and tell the story a little bit of life growing up and exactly what happened.
Well, growing up in Alabama, I had the privilege of, I call it living a great life. I loved sports. I loved playing sports and always look forward to one day getting married. But when I turned 29, it changed. One day the police came and had a warrant for me, and I didn't know what the warrant was for, but they asked me, was I Anthony Hinton? I said, yes. And they said, we have a warrant for your arrest. And I said, what are the charges? And they said, we'll explain it to you later. They said, well, right now we want you to put your hands behind your back, and I did, and they put the handcuff on me, not knowing at that moment that it would be 30 years later before I came home. And I was first charged with first-degree robbery, first-degree kidnap, first-degree attempted murder. And as they dug into those charges, they realized that I couldn't have done those charges. And so they dropped all those charges. They then put two new charges on me, which was two counts of first-degree capital murder, which carries the death penalty. And I didn't have the money to hire a decent lawyer. And in the United States, the justice system is built around who can you afford to hire. And so I didn't have the money to hire a lawyer. And so therefore, it was easy for them to take me to trial and get a conviction. I went to trial. My trial lasted 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and the jury found me guilty of two counts of first-degree capital murder. The judge sentenced me to death, and once he sentenced me to death, I went to Alabama death row, and that's where I was for the next 30 years.
For 30 years on death row for a crime that you did not commit, and one of many very striking things about your story that I think is shocking is early on a conversation you had with the police officer who arrested you, who more or less admitted that he knew you hadn't done anything wrong. Just tell us exactly what he said and why he would have said that.
What I've learned about the justice system in America, it's not about innocent or guilt, it's about who you are. And when you don't have the money, as I said earlier, to pay for a defense, they use you to clear up the books. And they have the way in America, they treat you better if you're rich and guilty, opposed to if you're poor and innocent. I was poor and innocent. I was a black man that didn't have money. And so on our way to the police station, I never will forget, the police told me there's five things that are going to convict you. And I said, what are they? He said, number one, you're black. Number two, a white man is going to say you shot him. Number three, you're going to have a white prosecutor. Number four, you're going to have a white judge. And number five, you're going to have an all-white jury. And he said, do you know what that spell? And he said, conviction, 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 conviction. And even to this day, as I sit in this room, if I can meet that police officer, I would shake his hand because he was dead on the money. Those are the five things that convict me. And what struck me is he never said, we know you did it. He never did say anything incriminating that we got your fingerprint, we got an eyewitness. He based everything on black and white. And I thought at least our criminal justice system in America was a little better than that. But what I realized, it really boiled down to race. And they kept me in the trial, got a conviction, sent me into death row, and for 30 years, that's why I'm leaving.
Did you believe during that time when you were arrested, when you were waiting for trial, when you were going through the trial, did you believe justice will prevail, they will realize they've made a mistake, I had nothing to do with it? Did you have that hope and that confidence?
Absolutely. I think even knowing the system the way I knew it and the way African-Americans know the system in America, we all have that glimpse of hope that when you haven't done anything, you know, they'll come to their senses and realize they got the wrong person. I was no different. I really thought that they would get, ask me questions, I answered the question truthfully, and they would look at the time-wise and ask me where I was, and I tell them, they would say, hey, you know what? I don't think this guy done it. But that wasn't the case. They were so fixed on making somebody pay for the crime. It wasn't about making the right person pay. And I fitted the description. I fitted the MO, black, don't have the money. Let's get a conviction out of him. Let's clear up the books.
And this was exactly what this police officer said to you, didn't he?
Absolutely.
He said, just remind me exactly what he said.
He said, you know, in the car, he said, let me tell you something. I don't care whether you did it or didn't do it. I'm going to make sure you found guilty of it.
See, that's just, I think for a lot of people hearing that, it's so shocking to think that a police officer could say, I don't care if you did it or not, we just want to convict you.
Well, you know, as I said, I'm going to be honest with you. When he said it, it didn't shock me because, for one thing, he was blunt honest. Second, he knew the system well enough to know that he could tell me that. And the third, he was telling me, listen, I don't care really whether you did it or not, but I'm going to make sure you found guilty of it. And that's the system that we live under in America. Don't have to be evidence. It just is, we're going to clear the books up on you.
So tell me what your memories are of that trial and the evidence, quote unquote, that led to you spending 30 years inside prison.
Well, to be honest with you, there was, my case revolved around ballistics. And the fake lawyer that I had went out and got a fake ballistic expert for my defense. When they put him on the stand, in America we used to wear crucifixion. He crucified him. He was blind in one eye. He wasn't able to see the machine. And so when the district attorney cross-examined him, ripped him apart. And it was easy for him to get a conviction, but what stood out to me more than anything in my trial is when the jury come back with a guilty verdict. The judge said something that I will never forget. He said, may God have mercy on your soul. And it was as though the judge was saying, I understand that you're innocent, but I'm still going to pray that God have mercy on your soul. But that didn't stick well with me. It was when the prosecutor made those remarks. We didn't get the right today, but at least we got a off the street. I mean, what kind of prosecutor would say that out loud? And as I began to realize and read more about the prosecutor, the man that prosecuted me, he was racist in a calm. He wrote a book, and in that book, he said that he believed in the theory of Hitler, that America should be predominantly white. And that's the man that prosecuted me. So I didn't look for any favors from there. I didn't expect any favors coming from the judicial system. It was just something that I wasn't prepared for. It was something that I never thought would happen to me because I never had any type of violence in my life. And I just don't believe you wake up 29 years later and all of a sudden decide you're going to kill somebody, rob somebody for a few thousand dollars. But the system can come get you at any time. And it came and got me at the age of 29.
What was the reaction of your family and your friends when that sentence got handed down?
Oh, my mother was devastated. I was more worried about her than I was anyone else because I didn't know whether or not she fully understood that they had just sentenced her baby boy to death. And I didn't know that she understood the law enough to know that at some point in some time, they're talking about taking your baby boy life. And what make it worse was the fact that he hadn't done anything for them to take his life other than to be born black and poor. And to me, that was not worth them taking my life for no reason. And I think my family was shocked because we was brought up to believe in this system. I truly was brought up to believe that if you haven't done anything wrong, you don't have no fear of the police. The police is your friend. And always tell the truth. Well, I told the truth that day, and that truth cost me 30 years of my life, and had it not been for God's grace, God's mercy, it would have cost me my life as well. And so it's shaken my faith in a system that I always knew that didn't have me in mind, but you still want to believe in the worst of people. You still want to believe in the worst system that you can possibly have. You want to believe that there's someone in that system that have a little dignity about themselves, that they would say, no, we're not going to do this. We don't want to just execute anybody. We want to, if we're going to have an execution, we're going to make sure it's the right person. That's not the way it is in America.
You were brought up with a strong faith.
Oh, yes.
And your faith has continued throughout, and we'll talk about that, of how, you know, you don't spend 30 years on death row and singing hallelujah every day. You have your low moments. We'll talk about that. But just tell me a bit about upbringing. You know, was Christian faith there from an early age?
Oh, absolutely. I can go back to the age of four. My mother did not play when it come to religious. She was a religious lady. She believed in going to church. Even if she didn't go, her children had to go to church. You could never say, I'm not going to church today, as long as you live in her house. That even when I turned 18, 19, 20, or whatever age, you had to go to church. And my mom brought us up early to believe in God, or that God sit high, but he looks low. He can destroy, but yet he will defend. Or whatever you find yourself in, take it to God in prayer. And so being taught from the age of four, you grow up with a sense that we can't live in this world without God. You have to believe or not believe. And I often would say, well, we believe in Santa Claus. Why not believe in God? And so I love the fact that I could believe in God, believe that only God have the ability to make it rain. Only God have the ability to make the sun shine. And so to me, after so many years of being brought up in a religious family, my faith came easy. And I believe in God's words. I believe that God going to have the final say-so of all of us. And so when I got arrested, I truly believe that the God that I love and the God that I always believe in would never allow me to be executed. I was disappointed that I was even found guilty. And I won't lie, that part of me, I was angry with God. I couldn't understand that.
I'm not surprised to hear that. I think almost any Christian I know would struggle with feelings of anger towards God, of thinking, as you say, I've been brought up in a Christian family and I pray and God's got a plan for my life. God, what are you doing? And that was your initial reaction.
Absolutely.
So just tell me a bit more about that feeling. So this is presumably in the early months or years of being in prison? Just explain what your feelings were as you went in.
It was in the early years. I mean, you sit there and you're trying to make sense of it all. And if I'm going to be perfectly honest with you, I truly believe when I was found guilty, I truly believe that God was trying to tell me, you're going to be okay. But I was so angry, so hurt, that I wouldn't listen to nobody. I didn't want to hear God's name. And once I got to death row, the only book they would allow you to have was a Bible. And I had a King James Bible, and I throw that Bible up under the bed. I wasn't going to read it anymore. And I just didn't want to hear God's name. I often say to people, it's like you have a child. You love that child, but that child have done something that was not of your teaching. So you may spank that child or whatever. It don't mean that you don't love that child. You're just angry at what they done. And in no different way I was at God. And so for 3 years, I refused to talk about God. I refused to even mention God's name. And I realized that God didn't need me, I needed God. And I realized that no matter what, I still believe God loved me and God was going to protect me. And so after I got over what I call a pity party, I came to my right senses and I began to pray. I began to ask God to forgive me. And I began to say, Lord, if it's your will, I ask you to release me from this place. And I kept praying and kept praying. And I didn't pray about the same thing I would pray for the men that I had got to know were on death row. My faith just kept me strong. My faith just made me see that, hey, if you truly believe in God, what are you sitting here worried about? Just wait on God. He will come. He will deliver you. And for 3 years, I sit there and just was angry. Mm-hmm. The human being inside of me was saying, I deserve to be angry. Of all the people in the world, the one person that you couldn't count on didn't show up. But I didn't realize at the time that God had what I believe was a mission for me.
Yeah. Let's talk a bit about that mission. You befriended someone who would have been an unlikely person for you to befriend and for that person to befriend you. Tell us a little bit about what happened.
Well, as I was the man that was next to me, they finally executed him and that cell was open. And I was there first, and about a day or two later, they brought another young white male in there. And his name was Henry Francis Hayes. I didn't know that he was a Ku Klux Klansman. I didn't know his father was the Grand Wizard of the Klansman. Had no idea who he was. And one thing about death row in Alabama, when you come to death row, everybody gonna speak to you. Hey, my name is such and such, and I've been here such and such, and you try to introduce yourself to them. And so when I got to know Henry, I had been talking to Henry for about 2 weeks. I never did ask him his name. I never did ask him where he was from. I figured later on, when they felt comfortable, they'll tell you. And one day I got a note from someone that saying, asking me, did I know who I was talking to every day? And I hollered out, yes, Henry. And the note said, that is the Klansman that hung that young kid. And I hollered over there at Henry on my way to the shower.
I think, sorry to interrupt, but just to pause at this moment, the murder that this man had been convicted of, the details of which are actually so gruesome, yes, we can't talk about them on air. But let's just say this was an incredibly, incredibly violent, racist murder that this Klansman had committed on another young, another black person. So, and you hadn't realized that this is who this person was.
Absolutely. And of all the murders, as you stated, this was perhaps the most gruesome one that I had encountered. But my mom had taught me, no matter what one does in life, they still deserve some compassion. They still deserve love. They still deserve understanding. And she used to always say, no matter what you do, I'm still going to love you. And no matter what you do, God still loves you. And so talking to him, I wanted to know, after I found out who he was, I asked him, why you didn't tell me who you were? And he never did respond. And I asked him again, he didn't respond. But what I had to ask myself was, did it matter who he was? Did it matter what he had done? And if I was going to be truthful to my belief, the answer was no. Because I had to remind myself of what Jesus would often say, he who is here without sin, let him cast the first stone. I couldn't throw a rock at him. I wasn't there. I was had been convicted of a murder that I didn't do, but I've also had done other things. And so I couldn't point a finger at him. And so I got past that and I began to talk to him even more. And I wanted him to be who he were. I wanted him to believe that whatever he had been taught, I wanted to prove to him wrong. And so in order to do that, you have to allow a person to be who they think they are, to think that he really hate me. The fact that we talked every day, I knew that he didn't hate me. It's just the way he was brought up. And so over the course of the years, I would say year 10, we had been talking and talking, and I had started my own book club. I wanted him to be in it. And one day his mother came to the prison, and she didn't leave the prison. She died of a mass heart attack. And when his mother passed, we rallied around him right there on death row and tried to console him and say, hey, your mother's not in pain. We tried to make it as easy as we possibly can to let him know it's okay. We know you're hurting from the loss of your mother, but it's okay. About 3 months later, his father came. And I had learned that his father was the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klansmen in Alabama. But he had begged for me to come over to his table, and I went over to his table. He introduced me to his father as his friend. And later on, when I went back to my table, after visiting, I was over, I noticed he was sad. And I asked him, what was he sad about? And he told me his father said, don't never, as long as he comes see him, never invite a nigger to his table. And I told him, I said, Henry, that's your father cancer. If he want to die with that cancer, hey, let him die. And so we got past that, and his father came about 2 months later. And God would have it, his father died right there on the visiting yard of a mass heart attack as well. And me being who I am, I told him, I said, Henry, I don't mean no disrespect, but it's like both of your parents died on death row.
I mean, what are the chances of your mother and your father within weeks visiting you and both dying of a heart attack during the visit to the prison?
And you know, I wrapped it up as, Henry, you know, it's like God said to your parents, since you made him go out and commit that heinous crime, well, I'm sending you to death. Yeah. And I'm sending you to death, you're going to die right there, or your son. And we talked about it, and Henry didn't get offended by it. And I said, think about it, Henry. What are the chances of your mother and father die right here on death row? And as
you said, they had very deliberately incited and stirred up the hatred and quite literally told him to go out and kill a black
person. Absolutely. In fact, I've learned that when we began to talk, I asked him, what made you do that? And it was a young black male had went to trial, and he got found not guilty for killing a white police officer. His daddy didn't like the verdict. And so his daddy gave him, along with two other Klansmen, an order to go out and kill the first African-American male they came across. And they came across a 19-year-old mentally retarded black male, and they befriended him, and they got him in the car, and they killed him and did some more things to him.
Yeah.
And I kept asking Henry, what kind of love your parents have for you that they would have you to go out, commit a heinous crime, knowing that it's against the law, knowing that it's against God law, knowing that it's against man law. Why would your parents tell you to do that? And he would try his best to take up for his parents. That's what they believe in. And I was brought up to obey my parents. And I said, so was I, but I'm not going to do certain things. And so as years went by, his parents died. We began to talk, and we began to realize, and I did, that the hatred that he once had, I could see it. It was leaving him. And I referred to him as my brother. He referred to me as his friend. And the striking thing was, on the night of his execution, all of his family members had died out. And he wrote the warden and asked him, could I be with him on the day of his execution? And the warden granted his request. And I tried my best to make him just think about life, laugh, or not think about death would come in that night. And I did, I would say, a pretty good job of it. And about 11:30, we said our goodbye. But what struck me is the words that he said before he was executed. And he said, all of my life, my mother, my father, my community taught me nothing but hate. And the very people that taught me to hate are the one for the last 15 years. It's the one that showed me nothing but love. And tonight as I leave this world, I leave this world now knowing what real love feels like. And they executed him. And I truly believe that God brought me to death row to meet Henry, to show Henry that love has no color. And if it do have color, it can come from any color. And so to me, I truly believe this day that Henry is sitting up in heaven. I truly believe that his daddy and his mother never did ask for forgiveness. They never did change, and they are burning in hell. And I always, to this day, think about Henry, how in America we love to say it takes a village to raise a child. And I wonder where that village was when this young boy was being taught to hate. We ought to care more about children. We should care more about one another. We should learn that there is no room for hatred, especially if you're a believer of Jesus Christ. We should learn his teaching. It's nothing about but love.
How were you able to love a man like Henry, who you knew had committed, again, a murder so gruesome we can't even give the details, and who had deliberately targeted a black man? How could you, as a black man, love a man like Henry?
Well, because of my upbringing and because of the way the Bible and the way I interpret the Bible, my mom told me no matter what one does in life, they still deserve compassion. They still deserve to be loved. And here I was looking at this young man. He didn't have the parents that I had. I had a mother who loved me unconditionally. I had a mother who taught me right from wrong. I had a mother who instilled in me that God and only God is divine love. And so when I came across Henry, I felt this is the perfect opportunity for me to put into action what I truly believe. Love him, pray for him, talk to him, show him that you are nothing the way that he was taught that you are. Make him see that God have no respect of a person. His parents didn't do it, and so therefore someone else must do it. And I realized that he was never loved, not even by his mother, not even by his father. And so I knew that it would take some time, but for me, as a black man, it wasn't a hard decision. Because the Bible that I read, the Bible that I love, it says God have no respect for a person. And so that means I just can't love people of my own race. I got to branch outside of that race and also love them. They may not want me to love them, but that is my job to love them. And Henry was no different.
And even to love your enemies, as
absolutely.
Jesus said.
Absolutely.
You lost, in the end, a friend in Henry.
Absolutely.
And you are sitting on death row, you're locked up, and you tell the story in your book of even the smell.
Yes.
You could smell the stench of death.
Yes.
You've lost a friend in Henry. Was your own death something that you contemplated? Was it something that you tried not to think about? How did you deal with that thought that you were potentially days or weeks away from your own death at any given moment while you were inside?
Well, you first, it's like a two-headed coin. you try your best not to think about it. But at the same time, you're watching other men being led to the death chamber. In the state of Alabama, 15 years is the average that anyone stays on death row. You either get out and go down in general population or they execute you. And I had been there past 15 years, and I kept saying, I don't know how much longer it would be before they execute me. Although in my mind as well, I'm thinking about the God that I've served, the God that I love, the God that I truly believe in will never allow me to die for something that I didn't do. I had to hold on to that hope.
And you held on to that throughout?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Throughout. But if anybody that ever been on death row, whether they're innocent or guilty, tell you that the thought that one day they're going to execute me, because that's why you're there. You got a system that is fighting to give you an execution day. And that system was fighting against me just as well. So what I tried to do by not thinking about it, I tried to put my mind on other things. I tried to think about all the things that I love. I married twice while I was on death row. Two of the most beautiful women in the world. And after marrying those two beautiful women, I thought about playing baseball for my beloved Yankees. And 5 years straight, we won the World Series. I thought about playing basketball for my pathetic Knicks. And then it came down to tennis. I came to Wimbledon, and I won Wimbledon 5 straight years. I beat the likes of Nadal and Federer and all the best tennis players in the world. Here I am off of death row saying, bring me what you got. And I beat them. And so I often tell people the only thing that I am truly angry about is the fact that Wimbledon haven't given me my Rolex watch. And so other than that, but being a man of faith, faith keeps you from really getting caught up in everyday trauma. Your life is so consumed with trying to be this good person, trying to live like Jesus wants to live. And it was no different for me on the road. I had a job to do, and that is to, for those men to see the Christ in me. And I truly believe that I did that, and I represented God very well because I didn't have a problem on death row for 30 years. I didn't get into it with anybody. I always went in peace. I always left in peace. I always tried to be a light for those that was in darkness. I always tried to encourage them to seek God. And I don't care where you at. I can't think of a place in the world that you can be that you shouldn't be allowed to mention God's name. And so no matter where I was, I figured death row was the best place to not only mention God's name, but to walk in faith and to show that faith. And that's what I did.
Hey, this is Sam. Really hope you're enjoying this conversation right here on the Profile Podcast today. Could you do me a favor right now? It'll take you just 2 seconds to give us a rating and a review wherever you found this podcast. Just a couple of seconds to give us a rating is so, so helpful. It helps other people to discover the show as well. So if you could do that, we would so appreciate it. 30 years of your life, though, is there not a part of you that just feels aggrieved and angry that the whole middle part of your life was taken away from you?
If I'm going to be honest, once again, of course it did. When it first happened, I was angry. I was angry at God. I was angry at the men that did this to me. And I kept asking the why. Why me? What did I do so bad in life that I deserved to go to death row for a crime I didn't commit? If anybody know me, they know that I'm not that type of person. I didn't come from that type of family. My mom brought me up to respect people, to work hard for whatever it is that I want. So why would I just give all of the weight? And for anyone to sit and think that when you're accused of something as horrible as I was accused of, yes, I was angry. The human side of you, if you're saying you want to be angry, then you lie. The human side of you will make you angry. What is this all about? And I question not only the authority of man, I question God. Where was you? What did I do so bad that I deserve to be sent to death row?
And you still feel that now?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Because I stopped having that about me and realized that God had chosen me to carry out a mission. And I am proud today more than I ever have been in my life that of all the men in the world, he chose me to go and meet Henry and to show Henry what real love was all about.
Wow. It's amazing. You've mentioned before that death row, we've not really gone into the detail of what it's like. You mentioned the word hell before. Yes. To describe death row. So can you just explain practically how big is the cell? How long are you in there for? Is solitary confinement, so you're not with anyone else?
Solitary confinement, you're in there by yourself. Death row is a place where it's meant to mentally destroy you.
And that's why escaping into... You talk about starting a book club and in your mind marrying two beautiful women.
Yes,
that's
yes.
why that was so important.
Absolutely.
Because you were by yourself with
Absolutely.
That. And even daylight, sunlight?
No. Didn't see no daylight. They didn't see no sunlight.
Whatever?
Forever. Only time you was allowed to see it, if you did see it, is when the officer would try to take you out and give you 15 minutes of what they call fresh air exercise. And the prison was so short of officer, they never did or hardly ever be able to take us out. And so we got to the point where we didn't care whether we went out or not. You get used to not having, and you don't worry about it. You make the day right there in your cell. My cell was a 5x7. And I could lay in bed and touch the wall farther to my right. Or there was only a toilet mounted to the wall and a bed that mounted to the wall. That's all you had. And all you had was cement and mesh wire. And that's all I've seen for 30 years. And there was no air conditioning. There was no heat. You freeze in the wintertime. You burn up in the summertime. But believe it or not, you soon get used to it. And we had to get a lawyer to take Alabama to court just to let us have a fan, a box fan, because it gets so hot in Alabama in the summertime. And so you sit there and you try to find ways to escape. And I think the way I escaped it, to this day, I have people asking me, is there a way you can teach people to escape? And to me, when I tell about the two beautiful women, I mean, just think, you're on death row. And you marry Halle Berry. You stay married to her for 15 years. And just by looking in, you get Sandra Bullock to marry you. I mean, this got to be one of the best imagination one could have. And I married two beautiful women who had the sense of humor, who understood where I was, and they didn't give me any heart no, always was yes, and was I blessed to be able to marry those two women, you know. And so.
Amazing. So, how did you get out? And also, why did it take 30 years? I mean, I know you have people on the outside advocating for you and doing their best, and it's amazing that you sit here today because, as you already mentioned, when you're on death row, what tends to either happen is you are either executed or you are put back into the prison, but it's a life sentence. So to actually walk away from death row and to be sitting here as a free man is incredible. So why did it take 30 years?
Well, for one, I have to believe that it's the time God set. Secondly, you have to realize the system in America, that's the way the system is set up. It takes a long time when they're dealing with death penalty cases. You have the right to appeal that death penalty. And you are given so many rights to appeal it. And once you use up all your appeal, then and only then can they ask for an execution date. And so, it took the appeal process 8 years, 10 years, 12 years to make a ruling on my case. And that's why I know without a doubt God was in that decision. When my case came up on the judges, they really didn't know what to do with this case. I really believe that those judges knew that I was innocent. This case did not warrant me to be found guilty. And so those judges had to sit there, I truly believe, and figure out a way, how do we not rule against this man where they can execute an innocent man? And how do I rule where I can keep my seat as a judge? Because this system we have in America is suicide. If you want to be a judge, you don't rule in favor of a death row inmate. It is political suicide.
And is it the case that you don't want to overrule a previous judgment? So if a lower judge has decided and you're a higher judge coming in, you don't want to contradict?
Yes. And in the state of Alabama, we have what we call the lower court and the higher court. Alabama Criminal Court Appeal, Alabama Supreme Court. Alabama Supreme Court being higher than the Alabama Criminal Court Appeal. And then we have in America what we call the United Supreme Court, that is over all other courts.
And your case went all the way to the top?
All the way to the top. And my case is so unique that in all the history of all the cases ever been, I am the only person that ever had all nine judges to rule in my favor. And that alone is only by the grace of God. There's never been a case where all nine judges rule the same way. At least one judge going to rule against you and the other eight rule for you. Or five of them rule for you, three of them rule against you. But to have all nine judges to rule in your favor, nothing but God. And they sent the case back to Alabama. I go before the trial judge, and the states tell the trial judge, we lost the gun. The trial judge give them time to find the gun. They find the gun. They come back and say, Your Honor, we found the gun, but we don't lost the bullets. So she give them time to find the bullets. Now, and while they was playing this game, they was trying to find a way, how do we let this man out without making ourselves look bad? And finally, on April the 3rd, 2015, they notified the judge that they was dropping all charges against me. And that's when God had set the date for me to be released. There was nothing man could do about it. There was nothing anyone could do about it. But while I was there, God brought me the best lawyer in the world. And I say this without prejudice. God sent me his number one lawyer. He sent me the best lawyer that he had, all for me. And he gave this lawyer instruction how to do it, when to do it. And when he did exactly what God told him to do, April the 3rd, 2015, I walked out for the first time in 30 years. And I want people to realize, you go in at the age of 29 and you come out at the age of 59. A whole world had changed.
Yeah.
But I came out with a smile. I came out a better human being than I went in.
As you say, the world had changed. Did world events reach you on death row, or did you have a lot of catching up to do? I mean, things like 9/11 happened while you were...
We had a lot of catching up to do. The telephone came out and we had to catch up on that. Computer came out.
So you had no idea about...
Nothing.
Nothing.
Unless a guard would come by and tell us what happened. I didn't even realize that they had elected a black president in America until the next morning the guard said, well, we got our first African-American president. And what? Yeah, a man by the name Barack Obama was elected president. And he would keep me up to date on certain events and say, we got a black man running for president.
So visitors would come in and tell you.
And I always would say, well, he ain't going to win. I mean, I don't know why he's running. We'll never elect a black president in America. But I was proven wrong. And to be honest with you, I didn't care that much about it because I had my own problems.
Yeah, of course.
And it wasn't going to serve me any purpose. But I was not going to allow that to make me feel that we had come and overcome racism. I know we hadn't. Racism exists. But, you know, I want to say this. Death Row is the only place that I ever been that I experienced no racism.
Really?
Every man there treat every man with respect. Race have no place on Death Row. All of us is fighting for the same thing. And we all wore the same kind of clothes, the same type of tennis shoes. We ate the same for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. You didn't have steak and I had potatoes. We all had potatoes, that's what we had. And I realized that perhaps it is stuff that makes us hate one another.
One of the things you've said before was that, and again, this speaks to how when you were released into a world that was very different to 30 years previously, but you've actually said the world that you were released into, as recently as 2015, the world we now live in, you said is more racist.
Absolutely.
Than the 1950s.
Absolutely.
Can you give me an example of how you found that to be the case and what you've observed since coming out?
Since I've been home, I had the privilege to travel around the world. I had the privilege to travel all over the United States. And what I realized that the very Klan that used to wear white robes got smart enough to take off the white robe and go and get elected and put on the black robe. You look at the laws that they pass, you look at what they take and who they take from, and you begin to say, we living worse now than we lived in the 50s and the 60s. Every right that my mother and his mother and father marched for is being stripped. And so, to me, I look at a place like Alabama where I once could not even vote. Now they're trying to strip you of that voting power that you've been given. And so I look at economic. We are still in the bottom of when it comes to economic. We can't go and fill out a grant and get money from the government to start our own business, where I've seen other people go and seem to not have a problem get it. I look at the education system in America. I can take you down to certain neighborhoods and I can show you the raggedest schools in America, and then I can take you 5 miles from that school, and let me put it to you blank, point blank. I can take you to the white community and I can show you a school look like a college. And so we still have that division in America where the blacks don't have the school like the white have.
I observed this for myself. I was recently visiting Dallas. And I was in the suburbs, and as you say, fairly affluent area, seemed to be majority white. I hadn't particularly noticed that. It was only when I went into the city centre. And again, I don't think I see everything through racial eyes necessarily, yes. But it was just so striking that it was obvious that every single person who was homeless or who clearly had some kind of an addiction or who clearly, just from looking, you could tell was struggling with poverty, every single person was black.
Absolutely.
And I'm from London. You go to London, there's homeless people, white, black, and it's mixed. But it was a shock to be in an American city and realise every single person I can see who is clearly struggling with addiction and poverty, every single person is black. And as you say, you drive 15 minutes out into the suburbs, and it's like a different world.
It is a different world because all the politician, all the decision making come from Montgomery, Alabama. And all of the decision makers is white male. And unless you're able to see this as you did, most people will say that can't be, not in this day and age. Nothing has changed. If you ask me, it's gotten worse. because the people that need the help the most, they cut funding for them. They don't give them the solution in Alabama and America is, well, they need mental help, so why don't we send them to death row? And why don't we just execute them, because it's cheaper to execute them than to put them in a mental institution and give them the help that they need. And so it don't surprise me, because I see it every day, of the one that is struggling, the one, and that is not by accident. Let me make sure I say this, it is by design. The criminal justice system in America is not broken. The criminal system in America is working exactly the way it was designed to work, and that is to put people of color back into slavery. And when you go to prison, you're in slavery. You have no rights. You do what you're told. Wherever they want you to send you out and work, you can't do nothing but go and do what they tell you. And so I want people to realize that America is not the America that perhaps TV show you. Mm-hmm. If you ever have time, go to America and you will see. Visit this part and then go to the other part. And it's look like two different countries.
Yeah.
A fact is a fact.
70% of American Christians are in favor of the death penalty. How do you hope to change their minds?
I hope to change about keep telling them that it's not of Jesus. That is not of Jesus' teaching. And I don't understand when people say they're Christian. Well, did you read the 10th commandment? And one of them in there, I believe, said, thou shalt not kill. And it don't give you a definition of you can only kill if they kill. Jesus have always demonstrated, I love the story where the woman that was caught in adultery and how everybody was ready to stone her. But somewhere out of nowhere appeared Jesus. And he said, he who is here without sin, let him cast the first stone. That tells me that Jesus was not about killing. Although this woman was caught in adultery, he was her best attorney. And we cannot throw a stone. You may not have killed anybody, but you still broke a commandment. And I just believe that in America, for those who say they are Christian, they want to believe they are Christian. Christian will never be for the death penalty. The Christian, true followers of Jesus Christ, not only believe that he haven't given us the authority to take a life, he have given us only the authority to try and save a life. And he said, there is no greater mission than that you will lay down your life for your brother. And we got to get back to really believing in the biblical part of the Bible.
And I suppose, you know, the Old Testament, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, if you live under that, okay, it's a life for a life. But as you say, Jesus seemed to have some things to say about that. You know, you have heard it said.
Absolutely.
An eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. Yes. But as you say, Jesus' teaching, and I suppose I'm speaking from a distinctly British Christian perspective mm-hmm. here, because here in the UK we don't have the death penalty. Yeah. I don't meet, I'm sure there are maybe a tiny minority of Christians who might want to bring it back, but in my everyday Christian life, I don't meet British Christians who are campaigning for that. And so as a Brit, I'm on fairly safe ground in saying the teaching of Jesus would seem to suggest this, you know, there's no appetite in the UK for any kind of capital punishment. Yeah. And from a Christian perspective, we'd use the same scriptures you do.
But in
America, it's very different.
It's different because people wants to hang on to the Old Testament. And my belief is that Jesus came to do away with the Old Testament. We are under grace now. And so when you're talking about the Old Testament, we no longer living under the Old Testament. He died and he came down and we under his grace. And his grace and mercy teaches me that we shouldn't have a death penalty. And I think it's high time that ministers, preachers, evangelists, whatever they go about these days, it's time that we start teaching the true meaning and about Jesus and let people understand that we are born of the grace spirit now and not of the Old Testament. And there's no way, I believe, that you or anyone else would make it in heaven believing in the death penalty. I believe that Jesus have given us every opportunity to see that he is about life and about saving life. Every time I see someone say, I'm for the death penalty, and I say, why? Well, because he committed a crime. And I often wonder, if you was to tell the truth what you've done in life, what punishment do you think you deserve? It's easy for me to say, kill him, because I haven't killed anyone. No one in my family have killed anyone, therefore. But we seem to think different when someone that we love, we don't want them to be killed.
Well, I think that's what's so powerful about your story is when you meet Christians and they say, I'm in favour of the death penalty, you can say to them, well, with a political belief like that, you would be in favour of me
absolutely
being in the electric chair. And as soon as you personalise it like that,
yes,
and you realise there are people, not all, but there are some on death row who did not commit absolutely a crime and you want them to be absolutely killed, I think it hits home, doesn't it?
It hit home, and not only that, us in America, it been 195 exonerees. That means that they have been proven not to have committed the crime. And these men and women came off of death row from various states. That's other one that we know about. Common sense tells me that we have executed innocent people. And I often tell people I would rather have life without parole where that person have the ability to always try and prove he's innocent. But once we take a life, it's gone forever.
But just finally, and sadly we're running out of time, but just finally, just talk to me about how you readjust to life after 30 years of solitary confinement. Because I imagine that is not straightforward. And you have had now 7 years
yes
of living in freedom. But I imagine there's stuff to work through. Is it, I don't know what the term is, post-traumatic stress or just adjustment? How have you found that?
Well, first and foremost, when you come, you have to have Christ in your life. The Bible says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthened me, and without Christ, I can do nothing. So first, the day that I was released, I knew that I had God was going to pave the way for me. Then I had my best friend and his wife ready to help me in any way that they could. In fact, I lived with him until I was able to get my old mother house fixed back up. And so you have to live a life. You can't be afraid. You have to truly believe that God brought you from point A and he's not going to abandon you. He's going to see you through it. And so with me, I am dealing with post-traumatic stress syndrome. I haven't had anyone to lay me down or treat me. But I often tell people, I have the best psychiatrist in the world, and that is my Heavenly Father, who lead me and guide me every day and who continue to give me strength. You use the word freedom. I will never believe that I'm free. I will set free, but I won't never be free because of the post-traumatic stress syndrome that I have. Every time Alabama get ready to execute someone, I have to relive that 30 years over and over again. And sadly to say, on September the 27th, Alabama is scheduled to take another human being life. Again, I have to deal with that. I know exactly what that particular inmate is going through. I know exactly what the man's on death row is trying to be there for him and rally him and say, hey, you're going to get a state execution. But when you have a system that you come out, I have my best friend, I have my lawyer, I have the Equal Justice Initiative, my adopted family, and every man and every woman that comes off death row don't have what I had. And by the grace of God, it's like I had all of these people waiting on me, ready to assist me in any way they can. And I am here today because of the help that God has provided for me and the things that he is doing for me.
Well, Anthony, it's been an honour to hear your story, and there is loads more detail people can get in your best-selling book,
Absolutely.
The Sun Does Shine. But thank you so much for giving us some of your time and sharing your remarkable story with us.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for listening to The Profile Podcast this week. I'm Sam Hales, editor of Premier Christianity magazine, the UK's leading Christian magazine. If you enjoyed this interview, you are sure to love the magazine, where we bring you other inspirational stories, the latest news and analysis on what it means for you in your Christian life, what God is doing in the UK church and beyond. We're publishing new stories every day online and a fantastic quality print magazine every month. Join the community now and subscribe. PremierChristianity.com is the place to go, and our latest special offer will give you 6 print issues and full online access for just £9.99, less than £10 to get the next 6 issues of the UK's leading Christian magazine. Grab that offer right now, PremierChristianity.com. We will be back same time, same place next week with another great interview for you. See you then.
You've been listening to The Profile in association with Premier Christianity magazine.